From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
BP has been operating for many years a corrupt corrosion control program in order to cut costs, and now the consumer and the public is going to pay for it.
Did BP purposefully allow its Alaska pipeline to corrode in order to shut it down and boost oil prices? We'll speak with longtime oil industry watchdog Chuck Hamill. Then, as the Israeli assault on Lebanon enters its 30th day, scientists are scrambling to control what's being described as the worst environmental disaster ever to hit Lebanon. And an Israeli attack on a power station has leaked 15,000 tons of oil into the Mediterranean. The spill has gone untreated for the past month. We'll go to Beirut for a report. Israel's ambassador to the United States comes under critical questioning during a press stakeout.
So this report, I don't know what credence, it's absurd and it's totally false. And I must say, I will question the motivations of them and who wrote it.
Sir, this is from Human Rights Watch. They also put out a report criticizing Hezbollah. And if you are a Hezbollah spokesperson, I would be asking you that question. They are talking about you using cluster bombs which and targeting civilians indiscriminately. Are you involved in this mission?
No, not at all.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The British government announced today it's thwarted a plot to blow up 10 airplanes making flights to the United States. Britain's Home Secretary John Reid spoke earlier today.
Overnight, the police, with the full knowledge of ministers, have carried out a major counter-terrorism operation to disrupt what we believe to be a major threat to the United Kingdom and international partners. The police, acting with the security service MI5, are investigating an alleged plot to bring down a number of aircraft through mid-flight explosions, causing a considerable loss of life.
At least 21 people have been arrested. London's Heathrow Airport has suspended all incoming flights. Hand luggage has been banned on all flights leaving Britain. Israel's cabinet has voted to expand the invasion of Lebanon. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow warned both sides against an escalation, but it appears the Bush administration has approved the offensive. According to the Washington Post, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice did not ask Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to hold back on a new assault when they spoke on Wednesday. A dozen Lebanese civilians were reported killed in the latest Israeli airstrikes. Lebanon's death toll is believed to be more than 1,000. Thousands have been wounded and an estimated 1 million people displaced. Meanwhile, Israel suffered its worst single-day military toll Wednesday since it invaded Lebanon last month. 15 Israeli soldiers were killed in clashes with Hezbollah. At least two dozen soldiers were injured and several tanks left in ruins. Hezbollah continues to fire rockets into northern Israel, more than 150 on Wednesday. No casualties were reported. As Israel decided to expand its offensive, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah released a new statement Wednesday pledging a fierce resistance.
I say to the Zionists, you can come here and go anywhere you like. You can invade and deploy your troops that are brought by air and to enter villages or military points. This is nothing new, and I repeat my position, but you will pay a heavy price for all of this. You will not be able to stay in our land, and if you come in, we will force you out. We will turn our precious southern land into a graveyard for the occupying Zionists.
Nasrallah went on to call for all Arab Israelis to leave the Israeli city of Haifa. Nasrallah said he was saddened Hezbollah rockets have killed Haifa's Arab residents and said the attacks have been scaled down because of their presence. In a major development, Nasrallah also said he would support Lebanon's proposal to deploy 15,000 Lebanese troops to the border as part of a ceasefire agreement. Meanwhile, the humanitarian crisis in South Lebanon is growing. The UN is warning many villages have been cut off from aid deliveries and are completely without food and water. The British charity Oxfam says Israel's hold over South Lebanon has created, quote, a logistical nightmare in reaching the victims. Hospitals and power stations are feeling the effects of Israel's bombing of power stations and fuel supplies. The Lebanese government is warning a fuel shortage could shut down several hospitals within days. This is Bilal Masri of the Rafi Hariri University in Beirut.
We're not running on full capacity right now. We're running only on 25% capacity of the hospital. We're saving on energy, and a few words, we're saving on energy. There's no air conditioning except in the important wards like ICU, OR, CCU, and emergency room.
Meanwhile, in Britain, a member of parliament has resigned his position as defense advisor to Prime Minister Tony Blair's cabinet in protest of his government's policy in the Middle East. Jim Sheridan says he's stepping down amid concerns British airports have hosted U.S. planes shipping arms to Israel and his government's refusal to push for a ceasefire. Sheridan's resignation comes as more than 130 British lawmakers have issued a demand to recall parliament to discuss the war in Lebanon. In Iraq, at least 30 people are dead following a bombing near a Shiite shrine in the city of Najaf. Dozens more were wounded in the attack. Iraq is coming off one of its deadliest months this year. The Baghdad morgue says almost 2,000 bodies were delivered in July. In the occupied territories, a new report from the Palestinian Authority says Israel has taken 600 Palestinian prisoners since the capture of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. The prisoners include at least 62 Palestinian children. Two of the children are 12 years old. Israel has launched a relentless attack on Gaza in an avowed effort to secure Shalit's release. According to the report, there are more than 10,000 Palestinian detainees currently held in 30 Israeli prisons, detention facilities, and interrogation centers. Nearly three dozen elected legislators and cabinet members are among those detained. In Sri Lanka, Tamil Tiger rebels are claiming more than 50 civilians are dead and 200 wounded in shelling from government forces. The Tigers have been battling the Sri Lankan government for control over a water canal in Trincomalee for more than 3 weeks, 2 weeks. Hundreds have been killed and over more than 30,000 displaced since clashes broke out. Meanwhile, the French aid agency, Action Against Hunger, has asked the United Nations to support an independent probe into last week's killings of 17 of its aid workers. ACP says the workers were intentionally murdered in what they call a war crime. The rebel Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan government have each blamed the other for the killings. In India, massive flooding this week has displaced an estimated 4.5 million people. In India's south and western regions, more than 300 people have died during this year's monsoon rain season. In Mexico, election officials have begun a partial recount of votes from last month's presidential elections. Presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador is demanding a full recount of all 41 million votes. On Wednesday, thousands of supporters blocked the offices of three major foreign-owned banks as part of growing protests in support of López Obrador's demand. Just one-tenth of the country's polling stations will be subjected to the recount. There are early results from last month's elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo. With just 4% of around 20 million votes counted, President Joseph Kabila is in the lead with 72%. His main opponent, Jean-Pierre Bemba, has 10%. Final results are not expected until the end of the month. Here in the United States, Democrats are lining up behind anti-war challenger Ned Lamont following his primary win over Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman. On Wednesday, former President Bill Clinton, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, and Senator John Kerry were among leading Democrats calling on party members to back Lamont. Lieberman has vowed to run as an independent. Democratic National Chair Howard Dean called Lieberman's decision, quote, disrespectful of Democrats and disrespectful of the Democratic Party. Although support for Lieberman is dwindling, he may have at least one key political backer, the White House. According to ABC News, a source from Lieberman's campaign said President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove, has delivered a message of support from the Oval Office. Rove reportedly said, quote, the boss wants to help. Whatever we can do, we will do. Meanwhile, Vice President Dick Cheney called Lieberman's loss, quote, an unfortunate development and said it would possibly encourage Al-Qaeda types. Lieberman also announced Wednesday he's fired his campaign staff. Meanwhile, opposition to the Iraq war has reached its highest level yet. According to a new CNN opinion research poll, 60% of Americans oppose the U.S. war in Iraq. A majority said they would support the withdrawal of at least some U.S. troops by the end of the year. The world's largest association of attorneys has delivered another rebuke to President Bush. The American Bar Association's House of Delegates voted this week to call on the president to stop issuing signing statements through which he claims a right to ignore or not enforce sections of bills he signs into law. The ABA also voted to encourage Congress to pass legislation that would help put a stop to the practice. The vote comes on the heels of an ABA report last month warning President Bush is undermining the Constitution by claiming he has the authority to ignore laws passed by Congress. President Bush has issued some 800 signing statements, more than all previous administrations combined. The Justice Department has ruled FBI agents were justified in the fatal shooting of Puerto Rican independence leader Filiberto Ojeda Rios. Rios was killed in September during a raid on his home. Agents waited at least 19 hours before entering his home after they shot him. Autopsy reports show that Rios, known widely in Puerto Rico as Filiberto, bled to death from a gunshot wound to his shoulder. Investigators say the shooting was justified because Rios had opened fire on the agents. Pro-independence activists are alleging a cover-up. Independence leader Hector Pesquera called the report contradictory, saying, quote, "This confirms our initial claims that they never had any intention of capturing Filiberto, that they came to kill him, not arrest him." In labor news, Walmart has backed down on a fight against unionization at its stores in China. The retail giant announced this week it would, with government officials, establish labor unions at all its stores in China. The announcement comes less than 2 weeks after employees at one of Walmart's Chinese stores established the first ever successful union in the company's history. Four other stores have followed since. In other news, the coffee giant Starbucks has fired the co-founder of a union representing employees at six of its Manhattan stores. Daniel Gross, an organizer for the Starbucks Workers Union, is challenging his dismissal. Starbucks says he was fired for making a threatening remark to a coworker, but Gross says he was only speaking up for a fellow employee who is set to be fired. Gross told the Associated Press, quote, "By terminating me on Saturday, Starbucks has shown beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's an anti-worker, anti-union company." Starbucks had no comment on Gross's case, but said it does not discourage union activity. There's been a major development in the case of the Cuban Five. A federal appeals court has overturned an earlier ruling that they deserve a new trial. The men were arrested in 1998 and convicted of spying for the Cuban government 3 years later. They maintained they were sent to the United States to monitor violent exile groups calling for the overthrow of Fidel Castro. They remained in prison despite last year's ruling overturning their convictions. And finally, in South Africa, thousands of people gathered in Pretoria Wednesday to mark the 50th anniversary of the March on the Union Buildings. The march is commemorated in South Africa's Women's Day in honor of the 20,000 women who marched against a law forcing black South Africans to carry passbooks at all times. The 1956 protests came despite a law banning all unauthorized public gatherings. Wednesday's anniversary event was led by a group of women veterans of the original march. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country.
Juan, your comment on the report that's come out of Puerto Rico, the FBI report on Filiberto Ojeda's Rios killing.
Yes, it was released yesterday by the Justice Department, more than 200 pages in the report. And interestingly, the FBI Inspector General does admit that there were errors made, that they in the arrest, the attempted arrest, but he justifies the actions of the FBI agents. And he even had a section particularly trying to rebut an article that I had written in the Daily News shortly after Ojeda Rios was killed. In which I reported that there had been a former naval intelligence officer undercover informant for the FBI who claimed that he'd been telling the FBI for a long time where Ojeda Rios was, and he believed that he could have been captured alive. A section of the report attempts to discount that, claiming that they don't have any record at the FBI from its counterterrorism unit that they ever interviewed any former naval intelligence officer. Of course, they never talked to me. They never called me up to ask me. I would not have given him the name of the source, but I certainly would have given him the names of the FBI agents in Puerto Rico that my source claimed to have been on regular contact with, so they could have checked with him. But they did in the report say that they had gotten information in the past, and in retrospect, the Inspector General said, had they followed up those tips, they might have been able to arrest Ojeda Rios peacefully.
And once again, how the killing went down, and who Philibert, how significant he is.
Well, he was the leader of the Macheteros, the longtime underground guerrilla group in Puerto Rico, legendary actually on the island, and convicted of being involved in the infamous Wells Fargo attack of robbery in Hartford years before, and had been on the run basically underground, but still giving interviews to reporters and issuing pronouncements around Puerto Rican independence, and he was surrounded in his house in the town of Oldemigueros, and then there was a initial shootout that occurred when the agents first moved in, but then they left them to bleed to death for about 18 hours.
Well, we're going to move on now to our first report. It involves the environment. It involves oil.
Yes, and we go to Alaska. North America's largest oil field remains shut down for a fourth day. And it could remain shut for several months. Up until this week, the Prudhoe Bay oil field in northern Alaska produced 400,000 barrels of oil a day. The oil company BP closed the field on Sunday after discovering what it described as unexpectedly severe corrosion of the oil pipeline. The price of oil surged 3% upon the news. Questions are now being raised about whether BP purposely allowed the pipeline to become corroded.
2 years ago, a longtime oil industry watchdog named Chuck Hamill warned BP about corrosion problems, but his warning appears to have been ignored. In 2004, he wrote a letter to the BP Board of Directors that said workers at Prudhoe Bay were concerned about safety, health, and threats to the environment at the oil field. Hamill wrote that the workers, quote, seek to see the corrosion problem addressed and corrective action undertaken without further delay and before any of their colleagues at Prudhoe are harmed. Chuck Hamill joins us now in our studio in Washington, D.C., former oil industry executive who now advocates for workers in the oil industry. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Amy, nice to hear from you again. See you again.
Good to have you with us. Can you lay out what has happened and why you believe BP Prudhoe Bay has closed the pipeline?
Well, Amy, since 1999, I've been tracking the corrosion control program by BP for that thousands of miles of flow lines that they have. They've been cutting corners, budget problems, and the first document that came to my hands from the workers was in 1999 that they were not injecting the sufficient amount of chemical inhibitors to prevent the rusting. It's like the radiator in your car. You have to have the antifreeze has chemical components that prevent the rusting. Just picture of part of the months of the year, you switch over to plain water. Your radiator is going to rust. It's very simple. It's not very complicated. There's so much water in the system up there that comes out of the ground, out of the formation with the oil, that when they separate it out. But along the way, it rusts the pipes.
Now, BP has had a long-running series of problems and been fined on several occasions some very large fines for failing to properly keep up its lines there. Could you talk about that?
Correct. But in this instance, it wasn't just when you consider oil field workers. I'm talking about engineers, BP engineers, BP corrosion experts who have left the company because they wouldn't participate in their corrupt corrosion program. Everyone didn't want to be part of it. Those that didn't were independently coming to me. I'm sort of their outlet, anonymous complaints through me, to back to the company. And when the company doesn't do the right thing, then I have to go public. I'm not getting paid for this. This dime, I can't get a cup of coffee at Starbucks, but I'm a prisoner of these concerned individuals, and they're not just, they're engineers, they're corrosion experts who fear for the lives of their former colleagues and who work in the process centers, which are very volatile situations. And that's what I've been involved with, whether they like it or not, I have to help them for fear that they're going to blow themselves up.
Chuck Hamill, you have a long history watching BP over, more than 15 years. In fact, you settled a case with them when they... Did they hire Wackenhut to investigate you?
BP, who was running the Alaska pipeline, engaged the Wackenhut Security Company, five undercover women to surveil my wife and me in trying to discredit me, hidden cameras in hotel rooms. And all five of the ladies realized that I wasn't the bad person that they tried to make me out to be, to discredit me. And they all came over to us side. I think 60 Minutes called them Chucky's Angels. But what we're getting down to, Amy, is they were discovered, and then they attacked me. $18 million worth of legal activities going on around me. A van in front of my home, picking off our phones, picking up our trash, and all that, you know, I could live with. But trying to discredit me with women, that hurt. I mean, that going BP fashion, but a little too far.
We invited a representative from BP to appear on the program, but they didn't respond to our request.
May I ask who you invited?
Well, BP America Chair Bob Malone did release a statement Tuesday that read in part, quote, "Our priorities moving forward are to assure the safety and integrity of our operating infrastructure, minimize impact on the environment, continue the cooperative working relationship with the relevant agencies, and restore production as soon as it is safely, and I reinforce safely, possible." Again, those are the words of BP CEO. We're going to go to break, and we'll come back to speak with Chuck Hamill, longtime oil industry watchdog, about the closing of the BP oil pipeline and the rise in oil prices. Stay with us.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they wanna know what they're fighting for. The generals wanna hear the end game. The allies wanna prove the plan. But the oil men in White House, they just don't give a damn. 'Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Blood, sweat, tears and toil. It's all about the price of oil.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Billy Bragg singing The Price of Oil. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest in the Reuters studio in Washington, D.C. is Chuck Hamill, longtime industry watchdog, who's been working with concerned oil field operators, engineers, working at the BP Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. Now the BP pipeline is corroded, shut down. Oil prices are going up. Chuck Hamill, you've been talking about the issue of what has gone on at BP for a long time. Can you explain what pigging is?
Pigging is when you run a device through the flow lines that cleans up debris, sludge that accumulates, like in a radiator of your car. And they have not run the maintenance pig that picks up this sludge at the flow line that ruptured this past March that the media is all excited about. Wait till they see what's coming. There are 1,000 miles of piping up there that have not been adequately cared for cost-cutting benefits because they've had budgetary problems. And once you've pigged with a maintenance pig the pipeline, then you you run a smart pig through there, and a smart pig measures the wall thickness of the pipe so that you can find little weaknesses before they rupture, as happened in March, and it happened a couple of days ago, last Sunday, in another clothesline. So if you don't, in this case, I've known for 2 years that the line that ruptured in March could not be pigged, maintenance pigged, because it would cause some holes in the pipe. But I was sort of whistling in the dark a little bit. I went public with that, but nobody wanted to hear from me on that. I was in the oil business, you remember, but before. Lord John Brown, the chairman of the board of BP, will tell you that we were friends when I was in the business. The last time we met was in 1999 in their BP headquarters on very friendly lunch, etc. Times have changed, of course, and they've cut too many corners.
Well, Chuck Hamill, you mentioned budgetary problems. The oil industry is in the midst of record profits and record revenue. So how could there be budgetary problems? That would be one question I'd have for you. But also, you mentioned this oil spill in March. There have been actually several oil spills in recent months. And isn't there a grand jury right now conducting a criminal investigation of what BP did in relationship to those spills earlier this year?
Well, there's two issues that I'd like to do one at a time and repeat the second one. The second one, I'll go backwards here. Yes, there is a grand jury proceedings going on now. I instigated the investigation last March when the government special agents contacted me. They knew that something's wrong from elsewhere about the corrosion program, and that all the persons who knew about it, 12 of them, had come to me independently of each other, each not knowing that the other was coming to me for help. All they wanted is to safeguard the lives of the people they left behind. So that's one answer to one matter. And I can't discuss what I know about what's going on, except that my witnesses are all subpoenaed and testifying in that grand jury. The second question,
This one was about the budgetary problems.
Well, yeah, this is sort of a dichotomy here. You see, BP last year made, windfall profits of $2 billion at Prudhoe Bay. However, the way they operate is every year they have an annual budget, and the workers, the supervisors, are each given a budget to live with. If you operate below your budget, you get a bonus. And if you don't get your bonus. One way of operating within the budget is when something is not budgeted for, but you got to run the pipeline, a certain valve ruptures on you, then you've got to be able to get a new one. It costs money, lots of money. There's big money involved here. So you got to do something different. The worst, what you would call rupture and spill in Prudhoe Bay, was about a year ago or so, where with 500 barrels of very toxic produced water, as we call it, out of the formation, was spilled onto the tundra with a little oil on it. The produced water is more toxic than oil to the tundra. You can always revegetate, but not with produced oil, produced water. It's acidic. So I, on behalf of the workers, went public at that occasion and said that they used a 10-inch, big one, second-hand valve from the scrapyard. When I mean scrapyard, I mean to be scrapped. And that was used because it was a produced water line, a new one, and they were lacking one, so they didn't buy a new one to use that. And 11 months later, it ruptured. So, of course, the political problem for BP was to deny that it was from the scrapyard, except that it was reconditioned and hydro-tested and all that good stuff, and thousands of dollars. It's in Financial Times and I think other newspapers. So that shot that down, what I was trying to say. I waited a while. I'm very patient. And after I knew that they would have had to give a special report of what happened and deny my contentions to the ADEC, the state agency, and EPA.
Chuck Hamill, we just have 1 minute to go.
They falsified the report, and 72 pages. And total falsehood. That's how things operate in Prudhoe. It's sort of an unregulated oil field.
In all of this, is BP going to make money with the oil prices going up, even with closing the pipeline?
I'm not an expert there, but I don't see how they've ever lost before. You and I are going to still buy our gas, and whatever the price is, we're going to pay for it. Their lost image, of course, is going to finally catch up to them.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Chuck Hamill, for joining us. Longtime oil industry watchdog from Exxon to BP, hounded by BP, investigated by Wackenhut, ultimately won millions of dollars as a result of their going after this environmental whistleblower. This is Democracy Now! As we continue on the issue of the environment from Alaska to Lebanon. Juan?
Yes, well, as the Israeli assault on Lebanon enters its 30th day, scientists are scrambling to control what is being described as the worst environmental disaster ever to hit Lebanon. 4 weeks ago, the Israeli military attacked a power station on the Lebanese coast, blowing up the plant's five large fuel tanks. Since then, around 15,000 tons of oil have leaked into the Mediterranean Sea. Satellite images show the spill has already reached as far north as Syria. 70 miles of coastline have already been polluted. Environmentalists fear the spill could also end up affecting Cyprus, Turkey, and Greece.
For the past month, the oil spill has gone untreated because of the ongoing Israeli air attacks and naval blockade. One United Nations official described the situation as a, quote, environmental massacre. Friends of the Earth has warned this spill, if left unchecked, threatens to be the greatest environmental disaster ever in the eastern Mediterranean. Lebanon's environment minister, Yaqub Saraf, will be joining us on the phone from Beirut. And we're joined by Wael Mandan, coordinator of the Oil Spill Working Group, a newly formed coalition of environmental groups in Lebanon. He's the former Greenpeace campaigner for the Arab world. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi. Wael is joining us from Beirut. Can you describe the situation of the oil spill, where it stands now?
Well, where it stands there, it's a complete catastrophe. And I'm not exaggerating here. We're in a state of total devastation of our marine environment. The oil spill, which has happened more than 3 weeks ago, no one has started the cleanup process yet. It has spread over 100 kilometers of Lebanese coastline. It has reached Syria, contaminated 7 kilometers in Syria, and there's a possibility it would reach Turkey or Greece. The problem is that this issue is not getting the importance it deserves. The amount of 15,000 tons, which is almost half of the amount of the Exxon Valdez spill, although it's smaller than the Exxon Valdez spill, UNEP, which is the environmental program, has labeled this spill as more dangerous than the Exxon Valdez. Unfortunately, all the things happening around the massacres, the acts, made this spill as another collateral damage, and it didn't get the importance it deserves. If this spill has happened without any other disturbing news, it would be the event of the year in the Mediterranean Basin. We have not started cleanup process, and every day we delay, the damage is growing exponentially. The impact on the environment is growing. Also, the cleanup will be even much harder because the oil will start to stick on the rock, be absorbed on the rock, go deeper into the sand, and disperse more in the sea and the seabed. So what we have decided as NGOs to do is go down on the ground and start cleanup as soon as possible, with or without ceasefire, because there is a danger still to go and clean up when you're under attack. There are bombs falling on our heads, and they cannot use any boats or planes because we're under siege. But the situation cannot take it anymore. We will suffer from this environmental problem for decades. It's going to affect our ecosystem for years. And the cost now of the damage have exceeded $200 million, and they're growing daily. So I don't know how to express it more, but it is a state of total devastation. Our fisheries have been struck at their heart. Our fishermen will suffer for years to come. Our tourism will be impacted for years to come.
We're also joined on the line from Lebanon by Yaqub Sarraf, the Environment Minister of Lebanon. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Yes, good morning. I wish you a very pleasant day, and I thank you for taking the trouble of calling us to Lebanon to try to transmit whatever we are trying to achieve and what we are feeling and thinking.
Can you tell us about the spill? Has a source of the spill now been shut down? And what is your government able to do at this stage in terms of cleanup?
Yes, we did manage last week to prevent any more spillage from reaching the sea. We have erected earth barriers with bulldozers to prevent any more spillage. Moreover, we finally managed to turn off the blazing fire which had been burning in the fuel storage facilities for approximately 12 days.
Right now, how difficult is it to get to the area?
It goes without saying that the area where potentially we have spread spill is a huge area spanning approximately 140 kilometers in length and up to 20 kilometers in width. Unluckily, we haven't had yet until now any security clearance to approach the waters, and it goes without saying that the whole Lebanese territorial waters are under embargo. So the only access we are having is on the shoreline, and we have managed to survey the whole length of the part of the shoreline which has been already hit by the spill.
And have you communicated at all with the Israeli government or the United States or the UN about the necessity to get some kind of clearance to be able to begin the cleanup?
It goes without saying that we have had contacts as early as the 18th of the month with the United Nations Environment Program, the Mediterranean Action Plan, and with the REMPEC, which is the Response to Emergency Marine Center. And during our first contacts, we needed more of an assessment capacity and along with the treatment. And we even asked to have access for a small boat to be able to go out in the sea in excess. That was denied. We asked for aerial photographies to be provided. That was denied too. And we finally got the first satellite imagery, being radar satellite imagery. We got it on the 2nd of August. And this is where, looking at the image of this spill, I have sent an appeal not only for saving Lebanese environmental costs, but also to put Turkey and Cyprus on alert status. Because it looks that parts of the spill, which we cannot define in terms of magnitude right now, might be drifting and might hit Turkey and Syria, knowing that we have had information through you, the United Nations Environment Program, that part of this spill has already hit the Syrian shoreline.
We're talking to the Lebanese Environment Minister, Yaqub Sarraf. Looking at articles in BBC and other places, it says marine experts from InfoRAC, an organization with links to the United Nations Environment Program, issued a warning this week that the raid on the Gea power plant in mid-July could pose a cancer risk to people living in the area. A spokeswoman, Simonetta Lombardo, said the spill of fuel oil is a high-risk toxic cocktail made up of substances which cause cancer and damage the endocrine system. Minister Yaqub Sarraf, can you comment on this?
Yeah, I think it goes without saying that the environmental impact of such an aggression is not only due to the spill. you have to note that we have had a huge fire blazing in those tanks for approximately 12 days. And with all the emissions of toxic gases and fumes, we have experienced outfalls of carbon deposits all the way to Beirut, which is something like 30 kilometers north of the area of the disaster. And we can assess that one-third of the Lebanese territory has been hit by those poisonous fumes, the fumes which are emanating from the fire itself. And that will have definitely direct problems in respiratory systems and in the agricultural sector. Now about the spill itself. Yes, studies have shown an increased rate in cancer for areas which are subject to such a spill. We definitely have other risks apart from endocrinology misoperations. We also have nausea, vomiting, respiratory tract infections. We also predict a drop in the total immunity systems of the people who are exposed to such a thing. Not to mention, definitely, all the problems of skin diseases and whatnot for any living organism which comes in contact with the spill.
Yeah, I'd like to get back for a moment to Wael Maiden, who's with the Oil Spill Working Group and is also with the peace group, Lil Hayat, a coalition of 40 Lebanese organizations and NGOs in Lebanon. This whole issue in a broader context, obviously in times of war or terrorist actions, these oil facilities are especially prone to, they're fragile in terms of their ability to be attacked and then to create huge environmental problems. Your response to the ability of countries to be able to handle these issues?
It goes without saying that effectively, because of international regulation, those storage facilities have a minimum amount of safety features, and not to mention a few, I can say that we have protective enclosement walls around the tanks, so that if you have a spill, a part of the spill which is out of the tank is contained in an open enclosure. And unluckily, for this attack in particular, we have had the first attack occurring on the 13th of July, which started a major fire. At the time, we have used whatever foam and whatever capacity to extinguish the fire we had, and we managed to reduce a lot the risk of explosion of those tanks.
And also, I just wanted to get in the last word from Wael Hamdan, who is the organizer with Lil Hayat and held a peace rally in Beirut last week on this larger issue. We're talking about the environment, but then the larger issue of functioning in Beirut right now. What were you calling for in your peace rally?
Well, definitely the first thing we need is an immediate and final ceasefire. I think it is something for the good of everyone. The war now is not benefiting anyone. It is definitely causing environmental, humanitarian, and other disasters. At the same time, it's strengthening the Hezbollah position. By the way, for the people outside, we here on the ground, this is what the people are thinking. The more Israel is bombing and causing all these disasters from different kinds, Hezbollah is getting more and more support. So if anyone wants to achieve any objective, political or humanitarian or military, then can only happen in proper negotiations and definitely not in ceasefire, not with having a war or not achieving a ceasefire.
Wael Hamdan, I want to thank you very much for joining us, coordinator of the Oil Spill Working Group, a coalition of environmental groups, also part of the peace group Lil Hayat, and also want to thank Yaqub Saraf, Environment Minister of Lebanon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Fahey, Desperate Man Blues, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Israel's cabinet authorized an expanded ground offensive into Lebanon on Wednesday, backing a push towards the Litani River, which lies 18 miles from the border. The decision came on a day of fierce fighting in southern Lebanon. 15 Israeli soldiers were killed in action, the highest number in a single day since the conflict began almost a month ago. At least 100 Israelis, most of them soldiers, have now been killed in the conflict, and more than 1,000 Lebanese, most of them civilians, have also been killed.
Amid the ongoing bloodshed, top Israeli government officials have been making regular appearances on the major news networks in this country to defend Israel's actions. But in the corporate media, Israeli spokespeople rarely, if ever, face any critical questioning. Well, this past Sunday, one of them was taken to task. Israel's ambassador to the United States, Danielle Aiyalon, was being interviewed at the studios of Fox News in Washington, D.C. After the interview, he was questioned outside the studio as part of a press stakeout. Among the reporters there was Sam Husseini. He's communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He talked to the Israeli ambassador, but he's also joining us in the studio in Washington, D.C., to describe just what that stakeout is before we go to the questioning. Sam Husseini, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good to be with you.
Why don't you lay out what these stakeouts are around Washington, D.C. on Sunday mornings?
Well, all of these Sunday talk shows, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, this week with George Stephanopoulos, Wolf Blitzer's Late Edition, as well as Fox News's program. These policymakers, in many cases these war makers, go in there, get questioned by the Tim Russerts and George Stephanopoulos's and Chris Wallace's and so on. And then there are these stakeouts. The other media, stand outside the studios waiting to ask them questions, and just more generally, whether or not the media are there or not, these people physically have to get into and out of the buildings oftentimes. Sometimes they have a satellite feed, but they physically have to get in and out, and it's an opportunity for questions and a time to really scrutinize them. And that's what happened Sunday. You got to get up bright and early Sunday morning, and then sometimes you got to wait around for quite a while for something to happen. But that's the scene. It was myself, and there were two reporters, one reporter from CNN and one reporter from NBC, and another reporter who's who I don't know what affiliation he had.
Well, Sam Husseini, you began questioning the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Danielle Aiyalon, about the report released by Human Rights Watch that accused Israel of committing war crimes for targeting civilians in Lebanon. This was his response.
I would say this report that you quoted is just something out of this earth. I mean, I don't know where they live.
They have people in Lebanon.
I don't know who they have. We are also in Lebanon, and if you see, the difference is, you see that the Hezbollah targets civilians and only civilians. They use this indiscriminate Katyusha rockets, which have been converted, their warheads has been converted into a terror weapon with all these ball bearings, just to kill civilians. Now, they use it from apartments, they use it from mosques, and from schoolyards. On the other hand, we are using only precision munitions, even at the compromise of achieving our mission fast. Many of our soldiers get killed because we are being very careful. So this report, I don't know what credence, it's absurd, and it's totally false, and I must say, I will question the motivations of them and who wrote it.
Sir, this is from Human Rights Watch. They also put out a report criticizing Hezbollah. If you were a Hezbollah spokesperson, I would be asking you that question. They are talking about you using cluster bombs and targeting civilians indiscriminately. Are you involved in the commission of...
No, not at all.
You're a protagonist. How can you be believed as to what's happening?
Well, it's not very respected to me anymore if they come up with such ignorant remarks which do not represent the truth, and they don't know what's going on if they write these things. I mean, it is quite obvious that we have a situation here of a terror organization who embeds itself. Tell me, do you see of any Hezbollah camps in Lebanon? Does human rights see, can the human...
This is a quote, found no cases in which Hezbollah deliberately used civilians as shields to protect themselves from IDF attacks. They went on to write about Tana on the day of the attack. They did extensive questioning.
Were they there? Were they there? They're writing in... No. Yes, I was there. We were there. Israeli soldiers were there. No. I'm sorry. I'll ask you a simple question for the human rights. Can they direct us, you, or me, or the international community, to a single base of Hezbollah? Does Hezbollah have bases?
No. Hezbollah having caches in certain places.
Yeah. Do they have bases?
They talked about.
No. Hezbollah fires from mosques. Hezbollah fires. I'm telling you.
They fire from forests.
No.
They fire from orchards.
And they fire from schoolyards. And they fire from UN positions. It's just too bad that we work about something that you obviously don't know and they obviously don't know. I'm sorry about it. The fact that it's written over there doesn't make it true. I think reality on the ground speaks for itself. And the reality on the ground is that they target civilians and we target Hezbollah. The fact that Hezbollah is embedded among Lebanese civilians is a problem. But go ask the Lebanese about it and they will tell you.
Daniel Aylan, Israel's ambassador to the U.S., being questioned by Sam Husseini of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He went on to the issue of nuclear weapons. In the 1980s, Israeli nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu first exposed that Israel had secretly developed an extensive nuclear program. Since then, it's widely acknowledged that Israel is a major nuclear power in the Middle East. Again, this is Sam Husseini questioning Israeli Ambassador Daniel Ayalon.
Why does Israel refuse to acknowledge its possession of nuclear weapons? Again, Mordechai Vanunu, an Israeli whistleblower, has suggested a trade-off where you have a nuclear-free Middle East.
Sir, you are talking and...
Israeli's nuclear weapons. Isn't Israel's nuclear possession provocative in the region?
Who says we have nuclear possession? Have we ever said that? We said, the only thing we said... that Israel will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons in the Middle East. This has been our position all along. Israel is the only country, unfortunately, who has been threatened. Its survival was at stake, as countries in the Middle East are calling for its demise. So we have this, what you call, an ambiguous or policy for ambiguity as a matter of national defense.
Isn't Iran trying to replicate that by having an...
Is anybody threatening Iran's survival? Did we say that Iran should be decimated? It's Iran who says Israel has to be decimated. So I think you have to get your facts correctly and see for them out. I'm sorry, it's just a futile conversation here.
Sam Husseini went on to ask the Israeli ambassador about Israel's use of cluster bombs. In their report, Human Rights Watch documented the use of cluster bombs on the ground in Lebanon.
Are you using cluster bombs in Lebanon?
No, we're not. We're not using anything which is not approved by the UN conventions and charters.
Why did you bomb the electrical facilities in Lebanon?
Lebanon has electric... capabilities, which is running. They have running water. We are not targeting any of the infrastructures. We could have done a lot of damage, which we're not doing specifically because we're very much concerned about the humanitarian conditions over there.
The role of the United Nations in the current conflict was also a hot topic during the questioning. Here, Sam Husseini asks Israel's ambassador to the United States, Daniel Ayalon, about UN Security Council Resolution 1559, adopted in 2004 and called, among other things, for Syria to end its military presence in Lebanon.
You've been quoting from Resolution 1559. Isn't Israel, and hasn't it been for a long time, in violation of dozens of UN security resolutions, for example, 446, 451, 465 regarding Israeli settlement activity in occupied territory?
Not at all. I think you mix up between resolutions which are enforceable, like UN Security Council, and General Assembly resolutions. Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm naming them. Mm-hmm. 446, 451, 465.
No, you're not. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you exactly.
Security Council resolutions.
I don't know why you don't read your history. It's very recent history. We pulled out of Gaza completely, dismantling 21...
The West Bank.
Yes, well, in the West Bank also. We have offered to leave the West Bank. There was a Camp David summit in 2000 where Ehud Barak, Prime Minister, offered to give most of the West Bank to the Palestinians. They refused and they attacked us. So it takes two to fulfill resolutions.
You withdrew from Gaza unilaterally. Why can't you withdraw from the West Bank unilaterally?
Who said we will not? We are still working on that. Thank you very much.
Daniel Ayalon, Israel's ambassador to the United States, being questioned by Sam Husseini, Communications Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, with special thanks to Matt Bradley for the audio recording. Sam Husseini in the Washington, D.C. studio. It was interesting when you asked the ambassador about Israel's use of cluster bombs. He denied the use, but Israel has already admitted that they have used cluster bombs in Lebanon after Human Rights Watch came out with a report saying that they did.
It shows the systematic pattern of the lying, because when they're confronted with documentation on the back pages of the New York Times, they tacitly acknowledge some part of the truth. But when they're put in front of the TV cameras, they lie brazenly. That's the pattern of warmakers, I found. And also I asked him about cluster bombs because he was going on about Hezbollah allegedly using some munitions which have some sort of ball bearings, which inflict damage on civilians and hurt people and kill people. He was going on about that quite a bit, and that's what prompted me to really say, well, what about your use of cluster bombs? And then he just outright lied. It's extraordinary. He also, when I was asking him about the Human Rights Watch report, what did he say in the end? He said, go ask the Lebanese people, which is an extraordinarily brazen thing for him to say. I think what needs to happen is that we need to set up a substantial infrastructure of asking tough questions to these people. The mainstream media clearly isn't doing it, and I think that it's an important role for the independent media as well as the international media, the Al Jazeera's and BBC's as well as The Nation and this program. You put out a lot of fine information, Amy, and I try to put out a lot of fine information in IPA news releases.
How do you find out where people are speaking?
Well, the Washington Post is kind enough to publish that information on Saturday on page, usually about page C5 of the Washington Post. They tell you who's on what program in Washington, D.C.
And we only have 30 seconds, but the issue of nuclear weapons, asking the Israeli ambassador if they have them.
Well, I didn't ask him if they have them because I know that they have them. I asked him why they refused to acknowledge them. He didn't answer why they refused to acknowledge them. What he said was, we will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons, which technically is true because the U.S. introduced nuclear weapons to the region a long time ago. So it's another, you know, devious ploy. And what's more brazen is that U.S. officials will not acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons. If you ask the White House or the State Department, does Israel have nuclear weapons? Do you think Israel has nuclear weapons? They will not give a straight answer.
Sam, we have to leave it there. Sam Husseini with Institute for Public Accuracy. His blog is Husseini.org. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. That does it for the broadcast. A belated happy birthday to our producer, Sharif Abdelkaduce, and welcome back to Jen Hughes. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.